That's really great. Thanks. And I'm going to do, we're going to do a few thank yous and a few presentations of awards, and I will speak for a few minutes and then pass the podium on to Professor Williams. And I want to begin by thanking our undergraduate staff who helped to make what's otherwise a very big university a small and manageable and welcoming place for our students. So Delia Silski, Lisa Curtis, and Kathy Teasdale make up our undergraduate staff. And if they're out there, if they could just stand up quickly, I'd like to just say thank you to them. Yay. I'd also like to thank our concentration advisors, Kathy Teasdale, Merla Wolk, and Jackie George, and to all the faculty and the graduate students who make this department the tremendous place that it is. Now I'd like to thank the president of the Undergraduate English Association, which is an association that helps support the English majors. It does things like run a job training panel, a graduate student panel, faculty mixers, and it runs a faculty teaching prize award process. So I'd like to thank Matthew Ballou. If you could come up, Matthew. And what's particularly striking about Matthew is that he is actually not an English major. He is a sociology and psychology major, but still he's taken all the extra time this year to run this association. And he's going to now just bring the board up and thank them for the work they've done and then present the two teaching awards.
Hi. So can all the Undergraduate English Association board members please step up to the stage? All the ones that are present, that is. Yet again, here's another congratulations to the class of 2008. Being a student here myself, it is very difficult to find a sense of community here. And when there's such a large population of students, along with a massive amount of commitments to the school, yeah, it's very difficult. So from our grad panels and our job panels to the lit magazines that we've made, Xylem and Fortnite, which are great, and Xylem just came out a week ago. They're in the English department, so go ahead and pick one up. The goals of the Undergraduate English Association strive to create this communal atmosphere among any student who is interested in English, whether they major in it or not. Therefore, I would like to recognize each dedicated and motivated individual on the 2008 board 2007-2008 board, who helped with the UEA's expansive growth towards creating an English community at this university. So, I will start with our Vice President, Ann Ebers, Joel Arnold, Michelle Attar, Paul Feeler. Our treasurer, Elizabeth Doherty. Our Fortnite editor, Noelle Williams. Our secretary, Sarah Dorer. Our Xylem editor, Beenish Ahmed. Our other Xylem editor, Caitlin Cohen. And then last but not least, Xylem editor, also awards head, Laura Swanson. Excuse me. And then we have Fortnite editor and also an awards head, Elizabeth Gangarelli. Publicity coordinators, Allison Peach, Elena Azadbat. Is that right? Close. Vinal Desai, Erin Stacer. Oh, sorry, this is fundraising. She was fundraising. And she'll be the president for next year, by the way. Lorena Disha for fundraising, Mewish Kao Leek for fundraising, and Lola Ali Oki fundraising and also for awards head. And that's everybody who could make it that are seniors. So if we could give them a round of applause. So let's hope that our next board is just as great as these individuals. So I will continue on with the English Department Student Support Award. The UEA Awards Committee went through many, and I mean many, nominations for the 2008 English Department Student Support Award. Nominations for this award were collected electronically through the UEA's websites, and instructors were therefore judged on the basis of personality, teaching style and composure, and class content. Out of all the nominations, they narrowed them down to two. The UEA and its fellow English students would like to thank these instructors for their exceptional creativity, passion, and dedication as an educator. Therefore, I would like to announce the following instructors who won the 2008 English Department Student Support Award. That is William B. Worthen. And then the second is Aaron S. McCullough. Thank you. All right, so let's just give him one final round of applause. Thank you.
And as you can see, a lot of the people on the UEA board are sophomores and juniors, so they'll be around in the next couple of years. The next award I wanted to announce the winner of, and I should say the winner isn't here today, but the prize is the Linda Buell Van Boven Award for the concentrator who has striven against adversity to realize his or her passion for study in English literature. And this year it goes to Kathy R. Cooper, who, because she has a full-time job and a family, couldn't take the time off of work to be here today. But I'd like to recognize her by applauding her nonetheless. So. And one other prize is the Wagner Prize, which is awarded for the most outstanding honors thesis, or thesis in the honors program in the English department. This year, the prize goes to Alex Funt for his thesis, My Own Private Henriade, Looking Back to Now Through Shakespeare's Second Tetralogy. Alex, if you would stand up, please. And Barbara Hodgton was his advisor on that project. In a few minutes, I will introduce our main speaker for the afternoon. But before I do that, I want to offer my answer to the question you or your families may be asking right about now. That all-important question, why English? Or, now that I've spent 2 to 3 years reading and discussing and writing about literature, what do I know? The simple answer is that you know key literary texts in the genres of poetry, drama, graphic narrative, fiction, nonfiction prose, as well as the history of language, from the medieval period to the present in England, and for the later periods in those places the British Empire brought its language, beginning in the 16th century, Ireland, North America, India, and Africa. This is no mean accomplishment to know all these things. But now I'd like to offer a less apparent answer to the question of what do I know? Or to put it differently, what do English concentrators bring to the world today? I'm thinking of the world today as a place particularly structured around a global information economy where knowledge appears to be easier to access and capture than ever before. Sometimes as easy as encircling it with your cursor, clicking upon it, and dragging it into your own domain. You, however, come from a discipline where amassing facts, particular bits of information, while important in the way of providing historical context, is not really central to what we do. So, what is central? And why is it so important that young people who have been trained to think as you have participate in the making of knowledge as it exists today? Well, let me get at that answer with a brief and personal anecdote. 3 summers ago, my family and I were visiting my mother on the Atlantic coast of Cape Cod, my then 11-year-old daughter, Grace, who was attempting to create a mosaic mermaid for a contest at the local library, needed to go to the beach to collect shells. We arrived early in the morning before the inevitable encampment of bathers clotted up the beach. Grace walked one way, and I walked the other, and to my disappointment, I found nothing. No horn with a pink, pearly, tender inside as big as a foot, no marbled cone with a surface like a glassy giraffe's hide, nothing pretty and gaudy anywhere in sight. This didn't look at all like those well-stocked shelves of curiosities at the Nature Company out at the Hyannis Mall. It was just, or it seemed to be, just a lot of, well, sand. But the day was a lovely one. There was a quickening wind and the gentle susurration of the water's edge. I kept at it. I picked my way along the beach, bending closer, moving more and more slowly, losing all other worldly objectives but the location of the particular forms of beauty which this environment had made. Successively, each time I crossed that strand, one by one, filling my outstretched palm with shells as minute and subtly hued as my daughter's fingernails, the beach taught me how to observe it, how to begin to know its operations, its artistry, and its history. How exhilarating to use one's eyes and hands, one's curiosity and diligence to turn nothing into something. The analogy all of you English majors by now probably get that I'm trying to make is that my experience of shell seeking is akin to the practice of appreciation and knowledge making, which you have learned to do whenever you look at a text. First, you now know that an initial reading teaches you very little. It merely introduces you to the general contours of inquiry. You know that with every successive encounter, every single one, as you underline, make notes in the margins, discuss the text in the classroom, and analyze it in writing, that you will get more and more insight into how the artist put it together, and more awareness of the variant meanings embedded and camouflaged on the page. This, to my mind, is the great pleasure of what we do, but it is also an indispensable practice in society today. Why, you wonder? In British North America of the 17th century, the great majority of households possessed only one book. This book was, to them, a sacred text, and these families did what historians of literacy call intensive reading. They read the same text over and over again their entire lives. What we tend to do today in much of the world is called extensive reading. And if you count up not only the books, newspapers, magazines, and airmail, but also the numbers of words which scroll across your various screens, whether they're handheld or on your desk, on an hourly basis, I think you'll agree that the word itself, secular word as well, has become, well, common. You might even say cheap. What I propose to you in closing, English majors, is that what you bring to the world, a world saturated in devalued words, in habits of extensive, or perhaps better put, overextended reading, and in knowledge defined as data accumulation, you bring the practice of intensive reading. You understand that the function and the meaning of anything complex is never self-evident. You know that knowledge is patient, that it slowly builds with repeated inquiry. Understanding this doesn't consign you to a shrug of cultural relativism. Rather, it gives you the wise conviction that there is always more to the story. And whether that story is a fictional one, or whether it belongs to a real person, a place, or a nation, you will know how to transform an apparent nothing into a meaningful something. So that's what I think you have and what you bring to the world today. And I welcome you into it, and I wish you the best. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the afternoon. And I should say, in introducing Professor Ralph Williams, Arthur F. Thurnau Professor of English at the University of Michigan, as Director of Undergraduate Studies this year, I keep making lists of things I need to do. And on every list is Ralph's retirement, because Professor Williams is going to be retiring after the end of next year. And it has occurred to us this year that Ralph teaches about 1,000 students a term. So we don't know what we're going to do when Professor Williams retires. So it's been on my to-do list all year to figure out what to do when Ralph Williams retires. And I have not come up with an answer to that question, nor I think will there ever be an answer to that question. But he has taught probably everybody in this room, and he will do more of that today. Welcome, Ralph.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much, Scotty. I wish my mother had heard that introduction, Scotty. When my mom was in her last months, I would visit her in St. Mary's, Ontario. And often when I went, I wouldn't know whether I were going to be able to get through to Mom. And I went one day, and she was quiescent. Her eyes were closed. And I said, "Mom," and there was silence. "Mom," and silence. And I thought, what might bring a mother to the surface? And so I said, "Mom, they made me an award at the university recently, and they said such nice things about me." And an eye flickered open. And she said, "Yes, but did you believe them, Ralph?" Mom was still in there. I'd like to begin by thanking the chair of the Department of English for letting us use her office for this occasion. It is a splendid venue. When I speak, as my students will know, but as you, friends and family, will not, I characteristically give what I rather pretentiously call rubrics. And so I will explain to you the theory of rubrics. Rubrics are red-letter headings in medieval manuscripts and on, which give you a quick view of where you are in the progress of the material before you. And I must let you know, though it will be received with some surprise and dismay, that even here at the University of Michigan, students' minds sometimes wander during lecture. I can tell because they get what I call glossy eyes. And I know that they're thinking of the date they had last night, or the date they wish they'd had last night, or the breakfast they missed that morning. And if they have these rubrics, you say, in the course of the lecture, they may nudge the person next to them and say, "What in heaven's name is Williams talking about now?" And that person can say, "I think he's on rubric number 3. And you're back into the lecture, you say, and away. I give them as well as memorable phrases to which I hope they will return, to which I hope now that you will return in the rest of your lives and think on them and think what better you might have said if you were speaking on them. It's also the case, a favorite anecdote from my teaching career. We had a lecturer come from another university, and I shouldn't mention which one it was, but it was Duke. All right? And I hope no one here teaches there. But the lecture was absolutely dry as dust, at least from where I sat, dry as dust, right? And muttered away, but then about 40 minutes into the lecture, he raised his eyes from the page, looked out, and said, in the average academic lecture of 50 minutes, the audience thinks about sex 40 times. And then he put his eyes back down on the page and went droning on. I had no idea what he was talking about. I'm Canadian born, huh? And they don't tell us about sex till we're 50. And then they tell us it's too late, right? But I suppose that he might well be right. I thought, well, perhaps the survey was taken at Michigan State and that's the way it was, huh? And then I talked to someone from Michigan State, Scott, and oh, they were offended. They were mortally offended. They said, the cited frequency is far too low for us. And so if your minds wander during the remarks today, for whatever reason, here are the rubrics. And if you have a pencil and paper, I hope you will take them down and think on them. For the title of the lecture today is Lifelines. And since I can't be with you as I should so very much wish the rest of your lives and share your stories, perhaps you will think on these and bring to them the richness of your life. Number one, we will not willingly let beauty die. We will not willingly let beauty die. Number two, out of eight, I know it's one more day than creation took, but it will be all right, and I will get through them this time. Number two, words set free from necessity. Words set free from necessity. Number three, all this the world well knows. Number four, bring me the sunflower. Number five, to love that well. Number six, because it was he, because it was I. Number seven, I don't know. I don't know. And number eight, and finally, uncomprehending, impudent, thanks. I want to begin by speaking personally to you. When I was the age of you graduating seniors, I thought that the most important thing in life was to become a person of absolutely unchanging, unwavering principle. I no longer think that. Over the course of my life, I've given up many principles, many of them willingly. Oh, I hope in favor of gaining wider, more tolerant, more open ones. But I've given them up. There is one thing which hasn't changed for me from my youth on. I will not willingly let beauty die. Elaine Scarry has a book on beauty, and she suggests that we know we're in the presence of beauty when two things are true. Number one, we want to tell someone else about it. You want to turn to the person next to you and pluck your sleeve and say, "Do you notice that? That's lovely." And secondly, you want it never to die. I suspect that most of you will know the experience I've had. I was one day with someone I love very much, and the snow was falling on that person's hair, and it was the black of the hair against the white of the snow, and that person was beautiful. And my thought was, I want that person never to die. I want that beauty never to die. You've had that experience, haven't you? And so let me observe that in my life, like those of you who are older now, and as will be for all of you young people I love so much, you will have pain, and you live in a world in which there is much evil. I don't know a solution to the so-called problem of evil. I've studied all of those that I know and pondered them, but I don't know any solution to it. I don't think there is a solution. I think that it is not a problem to be solved, but a situation within ourselves and in the world more generally to be managed, and that we can manage it better or worse. But when we think we've found evil, we frequently find then that we find it in what we think to be evil people. And then because they're evil, people set about destroying one another to get rid of the evil. But you must destroy people to do that, and that's somehow wrong. But beauty, and here's my experience, you can set beauty against evil, and it will never solve the problem of evil, but you will be able to bear it, and maybe even to find the world a worthwhile and lovely place as you can create it in the image of beauty. There is in Archibald MacLeish's work, J.B., which is a 20th century take on the Job story, a little limerick by a man by the name of Nichols. It's about the Job figure. I heard from off the gray ash heap the man cry out who could not sleep. If God is God, he is not good. And if God is good, he is not God. Take the even, take the odd. I would not sleep here if I could, were it not for the little green leaves in the wood and the wind on the water, were it not for the springing of the young, the bursting to new life which you parents and families have made possible, were it not for the young, and were it not for the beauty of the wind on the water or on Scotty's beach, we might not sleep here if we could. And so we will not willingly let beauty die. And my urging to you is, number one, that in the course of your life, you create an image of the beauty that you love. Because beauty has one characteristic which is noted in Shakespeare's sonnet, that first piece on the pages which were handed out. Beauty is always going to pass in the wastes of time. God, Shakespeare loves that word. At least he returns to it again and again. He loves it as the best expression he has for the way in which time takes away from us and makes superfluous and destroys that beauty that we love so much. The first sonnet, if you will. When I consider everything that grows holds in perfection but a little moment, but if this huge stage presenteth naught but shows whereon the stars in secret influence comment, when I perceive that men, as plants, increase, cheered and checked, even by the selfsame sky, vaunt in their youthful sap, at height decrease, and wear their brave state out of memory. Then the conceit of this inconstant stay sets you most rich in youth before my sight, where wasteful time debateth with decay to change your day of youth to sullied night. And all in war with time for love of you, as he takes from you, I engraft you new. There's a marvelous pun on that word, engraft. It's a sexual term, engrafting. It's a gardening term. You graft a plant. It's also based in the Greek word graphein, which we use for graphics and engraving. And Shakespeare is saying, I know that time is going to take beauty away, your beauty, and I love it so much, and I will not willingly let beauty die, and I will write that which will engrave that beauty, a beauty which can outlast wasteful time. And so, in whatever medium you wish, make in your own time an image of the beauty that you love. And so, outdo wasteful time in the preservation of a beauty you would not let die. Number two, words set free from necessity. Here are some old Williamsisms. I have about 613 of these maxims, and many of you will know at least 600 of them. Words, poetry. What is poetry? And let me suggest in a brief maxim that it is words set free from necessity. Words are so often used in our daily lives in ways which indicate to us we're not so very free. Go do this, do that, deadline here, go do that. Submit that brief. Go do this. Call that person. Poetry is words set free from necessity. Words which frequently follow rules, but they don't follow laws. Do you follow? Yeah, you can set the rules and you can set the rhythm and you say, oh, that breaks the rule, but nobody's going to put you in jail if you break the rhythm of a line. What is dance? Dance is motion set free from necessity. We're going to turn to Toni Morrison's represented world in Beloved in a few moments. The world of a slave is the world where motion is caught in necessity. Do this, go there, lift that barge, tote that bale, do this, do that, or get whipped. I mentioned to someone just before we began today that my mom, growing up in Western Canada in the early part of the 20th century, found as a little girl of 8 years old her best friend, a runaway American slave. His name was Charlie Douglas. And he showed her the welts on his back from the slave driver's whips. He was a man then in his 60s. My mom used to say that when she got to heaven, mom was very sure of getting to heaven. She wasn't nearly so sure about us children. That she was going to look first for Charlie Douglas. I wondered if she'd look for us to see whether we were there. But it was Charlie Douglas. And he knew a world where motion was of necessity. But dance? I can't do it well. I'm a Canadian. You know, what can I say? Some of you dance very well, probably. But it's always freedom, isn't it? Freedom, yeah, some of you know how to dance. Who knows how to dance? Freedom, motion. There are rules for it again. You mustn't tread on toes. I found that out. And you keep certain rhythms, but no one's going to arrest you if you do it badly. Slap in the face, maybe, if you do it quite wrongly. And what is song? Song is sound set free from necessity. And here's my point. The study of the arts, beauty in the arts, is an exercise in remembering that at your core you are or will strive to be free. Toni Morrison, one of the great users of the English language, got this in her great novel, Beloved. How many of you have read it or seen the film? Oh, one, and the rest of you, just as soon as you can, as soon as you can. Sometimes when I'm out talking on behalf of the university, someone will say to me, Mr. Williams, in the question and answer period, yes? I understand that at the University of Michigan, a student may graduate without a required course in Shakespeare. Is this true? And I will respond, technically, it's true. There are very few students who escape Bill Worthen or Barbara Hodgson or your humble servant. They don't get away, right? But if one does and they've read Toni Morrison, it's all right. It's all right. They will come to Shakespeare. But Toni Morrison is one of the richest of the users of our language, gives us these words. It's about a space called the clearing, which is metaphorical for any space of freedom. It might be, at best, the university, but here it's a clearing in the forest where the slaves go, the slaves whose motions and sounds are controlled. It was time to lay it all down. It's the second passage. She, that is Seth, wished for baby Sug's fingers, molding her nape, reshaping it, saying, lay him down, Seth. Sword and shield, down, down. Both of them down, down by the riverside. Sword and shield, don't study war no more. And how many of you know the spiritual? Gonna lay my heavy burden. Come on, loosen up. How many of you know it? Oh, a few of you do. Gonna lay my heavy burdens down, down by the riverside. In slave language, to go over Jordan's to die. Down by the riverside's the riverside of death. Ain't going to study war no more. Right. Time to lay him down, Setha. Sword and shield, down. Down, both of them down, down by the riverside. Sword and shield, don't study war no more. How many of you know that part? Ain't going to study war no more. Any of you? Oh, of course you do. Good for you. In my classes frequently, I'll say, how many of you know this? I'm not going to ask questions. And hands all go up all over the room. Lovely. After situating herself on a huge flat-sided rock, baby Suggs bowed her head and prayed silently. Then she shouted, let the children come. And they ran from the trees toward her. Let your mothers hear you laugh, she told them. And the woods rang. The adults looked on and could not help smiling. Then, let the grown men come, she shouted. They stepped out one by one from among the ringing trees. Let your wives and children see you dance, she told them. And ground life shuddered under their feet. They'd never seen their men do anything but respond to, lift that, go there. Let your wives and children see you dance. Finally, she called the women to her. Cry, she told them. For the living and the dead, just cry. And without covering their eyes, the women let loose. In the silence that followed, baby Suggs, holy, offered up to them her great big heart. She did not tell them to clean up their lives or go and sin no more. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine. One of old Williams's maxims, we cannot live what we cannot imagine. That if they could not see it, they would not have it. Here, she said, in this here place we flesh, flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet in grass. Love it, heart. Yonder they do not love your flesh, they despise it. They don't love your eyes, they just soon pluck them out. No more do they love the skin on your back, yonder they flay it. And oh my people, over yonder, hear me. They do not love your neck, unnoosed and straight, so love your neck. Put a hand on it, grace it, stroke it, and hold it up. Saying no more, she stood up then and danced with her twisted hip the rest of what her heart had to say, while the others opened their mouths and gave her the music. Long notes held until the four-part harmony was perfect enough for their deeply loved flesh. Love your flesh. Dance. Sing. Use words as poetry. Learn the sounds and motions of freedom and never give them up. Keep them nearby. Number three, all this the world well knows. If it has not happened yet, there will come a time in your lives when, caught in the stresses external and internal to you, you will fall beneath yourself. There will come a sick feeling in the pit of your stomach. And what do? And how does it happen? As so frequently, Shakespeare will use sex as an emblem of this, as well as the site on which it sometimes happens, at least outside Canada. And there are two or three things which I need to pass on to you for the understanding of this sonnet of Shakespeare's. Number one, in antiquity, it was thought in Galenic medicine that we are all of us born with a certain amount of what they called radical moisture, spirit. Now, here's where a Canadian gets embarrassed. I need to tell you that the radical moisture, or spirit, was most condensed in the sexual fluids. Now, once you had used up your radical moisture, it was buona notte, life was over. Right? So the implication is clear, right? You don't want to use it up too quickly, right? On the other hand, you might not want to die by accident with a whole lot left over. So the point was that you used it discreetly, all right? Discreetly, sort of playing it out over a lifetime. And so with that in your mind, this sonnet of Shakespeare's, it is the one which begins on the bottom of page 1. It is 129. Shakespeare is such a master of holding the concrete and the universal, the abstract together, the inner and spiritual. So listen to this first line, the expense of spirit. In a waste of shame is lust in action. You hear it, don't you? We've all known that internal landscape of the desert waste and the playing out of one's spiritual resources in a desert of shame. That's lust in action, but it's also very physical here. The expending of the sexual fluids in a waste of shame. That's lust in action. Until action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust. Enjoyed no sooner than despised, straight, past reason hunted, and no sooner had, past reason hated, as a swallowed bait on purpose laid to make the taker mad, mad in pursuit and in possession, so had, having, and in quest to have, extreme, a bliss in proof, and proved a very woe. Before, a jibe proposed. Behind, a dream. All this the world well knows. Yet none knows well to shun this heaven that leads men to this hell. caught in the antinomies of our nature, in the paradoxes. What should such fellows as I do, says Hamlet, crawling between heaven and earth? We sometimes find ourselves in what we propose as heavens that lead us to hells. Shakespeare's caught that as a bee in amber in this marvelous poem of beauty. And we perhaps can look at it the more directly because he catches it in such beauty. And what do you do at such times? My next rubric, bring me the sunflower. What you need to know to understand this one is simply what many of you will know, that sunflowers will grow in very poor soil. How many of you have seen a field of sunflowers? God, turning their faces to the light. It can be scorched over with salt, but they'll grow. The second thing, because this poem was written in Italian, you need to know something about that last line. In Italian, you may say, sono impazzito di pizza. I'm absolutely mad about pizza. All right? You can also say, sono impazzito di Dio. I'm madly in love with God. Same word, same word. Notice this last line when you come to it. Bring me the sunflower. Madly in love with the light. And so the poem. Bring me the sunflower, that I may transplant it into my desert soil, burned over with salt, and that it may show all the day long to the azure mirrors of heaven the anxiety of its gentle yellow face. Dark things turn to the light. Colors flow out in a flow of hues. These words of mine turn to music, to vanish into something else. Is therefore the greatest of all good fortunes. Bring me the sunflower, which leads where clear transparencies arise, and where life turns to air as its essence. Bring me the sunflower, madly in love with the light. In those days, then, when you have fallen below yourselves or feel caught in the antinomies of your nature, remember something in your life. Some of you will have noticed there's a little sunflower on my windowsill. And on days when I come back and I think I haven't done for my students what I wished I'd achieve, for whatever reason I feel I've fallen beneath myself, I look at the sunflower and I remember, keep on aspiring, keep on aspiring, keep on going, keep within your lives. This is old Williams. An image, I don't mind what it is, obviously, but something which means to you that the true value of your life is not in whether or not you fall sometimes and have that sick feeling in the pit of your stomach, but you're going on, Ness. Bring me the sunflower, madly in love with the light. Well, my next rubric, to love that well. There's a long line of medieval thought on into the Renaissance, on into the present time, that one ought not to love this world too well, because it's transient. Things pass away. Love only things which are eternal. I don't think that's just, and Shakespeare didn't either. This poem of Shakespeare's, which I'm going to give you, urges that we love what is beautiful and therefore transient well, because it's transient, because it's worthwhile loving beauty. Listen to the poem, if you will. It's the one which begins, that time of year thou mayest in me behold. and I present myself to you. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon these boughs which shake against the cold. Bare ruined choirs, where once the sweet birds sang in me. Thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away. Death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire as on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed on which it must expire, consumed by that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong to love that well which thou must leave ere long. That's it. Love beauty. Love it because it's transient. And it is so fundamentally important a part of our lives. You can set it against evil, and perhaps you can bear it. Number 6, because it was he, because it was I. This is one of my favorite phrases in world literature. It is from Montaigne's little essay on friendship. Friendship is a relationship which was once thought to be absolutely fundamental to a life well lived. If you had not had a powerful, enduring friendship, you had not lived a fully human life. Friendship in those terms is not so much discussed anymore. And for you, young people that I love so much, have a friend. Search for one. Michel de Montaigne felt himself to have such a friend. His name was Étienne de la Boétie. And so this is the Steve and Mike story. Michel de Montaigne, Étienne de Stephen de la Boétie. And he wonders at the possibility of this friendship. How could it be? We might have been born 100 miles apart, and we would never have known one another. We were born near enough that we could know one another. And then, in all the eons of time, we might have been born 20 years apart. I don't know whether any of you has experienced a sense of knowing someone and thinking, oh God, we could have loved, we could have had a life together, but we're 20 years apart. Why couldn't we have met and been closer in time? I see some faces that say yes. And so the miracle of friendship, I hope you have them, is in some ways that you found a relationship, and in all the eons of time and in all the infinite space, you've come together. And then, why, how is it that you love them? Human characteristics are so hugely various. The miracle, you see, from Michel de Montaigne's part, is not that sometimes we miss friendship. The miracle is that if we try for it and we find ourselves fortunate, we may have it. And how do you explain it? And in one of those marvelous of tautologies, he says, why did I love Steve so much? Because it was he, because it was I. And that says it about all, doesn't it? Why did we love? Because it was he, because it was I, because it was she, because it was I. And there is no further explanation possible but the miracle of that finding of which he spoke, of finding two souls in one body and one soul in two bodies. Have a friend. Number 7. I don't know. There are many pathologies of knowledge in the West. I've spoken with many of you of some of them. One is particularly characteristic, it seems to me, of the last century and our own. Many of you have studied with me in the course on Primo Levi. To me, he's one of the great moral and stylistic presences of the 20th or any other century. Primo Levi was Torinese. He was a Jew. He was a chemist. He entered resistance. He went up into the hills above Torino, Turin. That was his hometown. He was soon caught. They were betrayed, and he was taken to Auschwitz. At a time when young people your age, Primo Levi was just about the age of most of you graduating seniors, when a time when one your age landing on the dock from the train at Auschwitz would have had, if you were allowed to live at all, not sent immediately to the gas, you would have had 3 months to live, say, perhaps 4, before you were shot or gassed or starved. He lived nearly a year. The Russians liberated the camp in January of 45, and he began to write. And over the course of the rest of his life, he became, as I mentioned, to me, one of the great moral and stylistic presences of the 20th or any other century. Many of you who are parents, grandparents here, will remember the Nuremberg rallies by Hitler, the great rallies on behalf of the Nazi program. You'll remember as well the Nuremberg trials after the war, at which many of those who had perpetrated the Shoah were brought on trial. All of you will know as well that in Nuremberg there is the greatest toy fair in the world. You will know as well that near there are created the Porsche and Audi and automobiles and BMWs. It's a famous city. Here there is figured as coming to trial before a judge, one Alex Zink. All you need to know to understand this poem is that the name Zink is an historical name. And that what was involved in this poem and in reality was that the hair which was shaved from the bodies of those at Auschwitz was sold and made into fabric. Alex Zink is figured here as brought to trial. One of the great defenses at, the most frequent defenses at the Nuremberg trials was, I didn't know. I didn't know what was going on. I was just doing my duty. I was just taking orders. The question here is obviously the pathology of knowledge associated with what Primo Levi understood as willed ignorance. The unwillingness to know what we should know, the unwillingness to think about that which moral and political beings ought to think. And so you may figure Alex Zink is on trial, perhaps before God. My name? Alex Zink. Where were you born? Oh, in Nuremberg, that illustrious ancient city, rightly famous, honest judge, first, because certain laws were passed there that are of no interest here, the laws against the Jews. second, for a debatable trial. You know, you can say one thing on one side, one thing on another. Who really knows about it? Third, because the best toys in the whole world are produced there. Tell me how you lived. And don't lie. It would be useless here. Well, I was hardworking, Your Honor. Stone on top of stone, Deutschmark after Deutschmark. I founded a model industry. The best buckram, the finest felt were made by the Zinc Company. I was a humane and diligent boss. Honest prices, generous salaries, never a complaint from my consumers, customers. And above all, as I was telling you, the best felt produced in Europe. Did you use good wool? Oh, extraordinary wool, Your Honor. Loose or in braids. Wool of which I had the monopoly. Black wool and chestnut, tawny and blonde, more often gray or white. From what flocks? I don't know. It didn't interest me. I paid for it in cash. Tell me, have your dreams been tranquil? Well, usually, yes, Judge. Though sometimes in my dreams, I've heard grieving ghosts groan. Weaver, step down. I beg you, younger and older, know what you should know. Inquire where you should inquire. Don't will to be ignorant of injustices, knowing of which you should address them. One philosopher wrote the problem of the end of the 20th century, and I will add the beginning of the 21st, is not a deficit of knowledge. It is a deficit of care. My next rubric, uncomprehending, impudent, thanks. What you need to understand this poem by William Meredith, which is one of my favorites. Two or three things. I invite you to watch two or three phrases. I will begin with an anecdote. One wants to watch that word naps. I have a son by the name of Mark. He is